We are talking once again with Maria Tomchik, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
We had planned for Job to be with us, but he had an unexpected trip to the hospital last night, and so and is back out, but can't weigh in with us today on what happened this last week.
He appears to be okay, but he's scheduled for surgery on Monday, so we'll see whether or not he'll be back next week.
Yeah. So, a very busy week, at least in terms of our
of the primary.
Primary and our theoretical democracy that we live in.
Yes, let's talk about the primary election results.
All right.
Turnout for this year's primary in King County was estimated to be about 40%, which is high for an election without any national candidates on the ballot, and especially high, I think, for a primary in August when a lot of people take their vacation, although you could argue that a lot of people are still doing staycations and that our mail-in ballot system, our all-mail-in ballot system, certainly helps people to be able to mark their ballots and mail it before they head out of town if they're traveling. And, of course, there were some very important local races this year, so that probably affected turnout as well. So first, let's talk about the ballot measure, King County Proposition 1, to renew the property tax levy for children, youth, families, and communities. This was passing last night, when I checked the returns, by about 62% to 38%. And that's very good news. This levy will double the expiring county property tax levy to 19 cents per thousand assessed value. That's about $114 per year for a property assessed at $600,000, or a little over 10 bucks per month for a renter who is living in a property with a similar valuation. It's a six-year levy, with consumer price index increases built into it of up to 3% per year. And the money is going to go to fund food programs, developmental screening, healthcare and mental health care for youth, academic support, rental assistance to keep families with children housed, and programs to deal with substance abuse, domestic violence, homelessness, chronic diseases, et cetera, in those same families with children. Some of the best anti-poverty programs around the nation are those that have focused on education and support for children and young adults in poor families, and for helping their families, keeping them housed and keeping them stable. So this is a very, very good use of public tax dollars, and it's a good thing that it's passing.
So. At this point in the count, it's also, it appears to have enough percentages, numbers to pass regardless of the trends that occur as the counts
late
come
returns.
In.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh,
so,
yeah.
Which isn't necessarily true for the other races, but.
Yeah, and we'll talk about some of those. Now, for the candidates, just a reminder for everybody, some of these offices are nonpartisan, which means and the state's election law is that the top two candidates in every race will go on to the November ballot, regardless of what party they are in. So just a little reminder there for folks. Let's talk first about the county races. Okay. The King County executive, 12-year incumbent Dow Constantine, is leading the pack, taking over 57% of the vote so far. That's a very strong showing for him. So he's going to be a tough candidate to beat in November. And that means that his next closest challenger, Progressive State Senator Joe Nguyen, has a really big battle to overtake him in November. Nguyen pulled in about 32% of the vote, but there were no other major candidates in the race. So there aren't a whole lot of votes hanging out there for Nguyen to try to gather up from other smaller candidates. Nguyen is running on a legislative background that includes the passage of landmark police accountability laws in this year's legislative session, and he has pledged to shift the county into hyperdrive to tackle both police accountability and homelessness. On the other hand, Constantine is running on his experience, his green credentials, and his gradual approach to police accountability and ending youth detention. So that's going to be an interesting race. Joe Nguyen is a great candidate. He's well known in King County, but Dow Constantine has the name recognition. He has the experience, and he's going to be a hard candidate for Nguyen to beat in November. King County Council, there were three districts up for election, all of them with incumbents. We're going to start with District 3 is in the northeast portion of the county from Lake Sammamish East and North to the East and North County borders. It's the largest district geographically in King County. The two candidates who will advance to November are 20-year incumbent Kathy Lambert. She's a conservative pro-business Republican who is taking 41% of the vote as of last night's returns. Fortunately, she's going to have a really strong challenger in the more progressive Sarah Perry, who took 35% of the vote and trails Lambert by only a couple thousand votes. So that's a pretty close race. Mm-hmm. Kathy Lambert, by not taking at least 50% of the vote, is really showing that she's vulnerable in this district. So this is going to be one of those races to watch in November and watch closely. Perry supports reforming the King County Sheriff's Office and standing up a team of social workers and mental health care workers to respond to emergencies whenever they can, similar to what the city of Seattle is doing. She also wants to expand transit options, build more affordable housing, and focus on helping small businesses and workers recover from the pandemic lockdown. So she's a very, very good candidate, and she has a very good chance of unseating Lambert in November, taking the King County Council a little further to the left. Now, in King County Council District 7, that's the southwest corner of the county, which includes Federal Way and Auburn, Pete von Reichbauer, the longest-serving incumbent on the King County Council, he's been on the council 28 years, took 53% of the vote, which has him positioned pretty well for November. He had a particularly strong showing. He drew three challengers in the primary, and the race for who will challenge him is very, very close. And that's one of the undecideds in this election yet. So this may change next week, because there are less than 10 votes separating Federal Way City Council member Lydia Asifa Dawson from small business owner Dominique Torgerson. Now, Torgerson barely campaigned and ran because she's had a long zoning dispute with the county over zoning for her business for Horseman Brewing in Kent. She has no positions on most of the issues. Dawson is clearly the stronger candidate, but the fact that there's very few votes separating them means that it could change and Torgerson could go on to the November election. But in either situation, I think Pete von Reichbauer is going to be really, really tough to beat. Partly because he took over 50% in the primary, and it's very, very difficult for a challenger to overcome an incumbent showing if they get 50% in the primary. So that's the situation in District 7. We'll talk about that next week. Currently, Lydia Asifa Dawson is about 9 votes ahead of Dominique Torgerson. And hopefully we'll get final returns next week that confirm that Dawson moves to the November election, but it could change. Okay. Now, in King County Council District 9, that stretches from southeast of Lake Washington to the south and east borders of the county and is the second largest district geographically in King County. It includes Renton, Maple Valley, and Enumclaw and the rural areas east and south of there. So a very rural district. This is a part of the county that has been very conservative but is beginning to tilt more progressive with an influx of BIPOC folks and immigrants into areas around Renton and Kent. Now, the 16-year incumbent, Republican Reagan Dunn, took a very comfortable 56% of the vote and is going to head to the November ballot. His opponent will be Renton City Council member Kim Conn Van. one of only two Renton City Council members who voted to keep the Red Lion Hotel shelter open for homeless people in Renton. She wants to tackle homelessness, affordable housing, and police accountability issues, but she's going to need to campaign hard and get a much better turnout of minority and progressive voters in November if she wants to get close to beating Dunn. And I should point out, too, that in these races, voter turnout in the three county council districts was in the low to upper 20%. So in that situation, the incumbent usually has a big advantage. If we look back at Kathy Lambert's race, it really shows you how vulnerable she is versus the other two council members, Von Reichbauer and Dunn. So, of course, because the turnout was so low for these races, too, it doesn't give us a really clear picture of what November is going to look like quite yet. So we'll see. Things could change, but it looks currently like Kathy Lambert is the one who's vulnerable and that Pete Von Reichbauer and Regan Dunn are positioned pretty strongly to win in November. But we'll see. So then, and that caveat there remains there that, you know, only around 20% turnout in low 20s in Pete Von Reichbauer's district and high 20% in Regan Dunn's district. So we'll see.
All right. So that brings us over to City of Seattle.
To the City of Seattle. Yeah. The Seattle mayor's race in a huge field with 15 candidates, including 8 candidates who actively campaigned, which is a lot. The race has come down to 2 folks with experience on the city council, Bruce Harrell, who took 35% of the vote, and Lorena Gonzalez, who took 32%. No one else was even close to them. Nobody. Colleen Echohawk was 3rd with 10% of the vote. And then trailing much further back was Justin Farrell with a little over 7%, Art Langley with a little under 6%, Casey Sixkiller with about 3%, Andrew Grant Houston with a little under 3%, and then Lance Randall and Jim Donaldson took around 1-2%. Now, if you figure that Gonzalez can pick up a lot of the votes that went to Colleen Echohawk, Jessen Farrell, and Andrew Grant Houston, she may win in November. I would expect Harrell is going to pick up most of the votes that went to Casey Sixkiller, Art Langley, and Lance Randall. But it's going to be a close race either way. And it'll be interesting to see what Harrell and Gonzalez each do to boost their campaigns in the next 3 months. Both of them have a lot of funding, in their campaign coffers. There are also, what do you call them? Campaign committees that have been formed by... Yes, campaign PACs that have been formed by outside groups to help get each of them elected. So those groups could also spend a lot of money campaigning for their favored candidate. And, of course, it'll be interesting to see who the candidates that didn't make it through the primary endorse, particularly Justin Farrell and Colleen Echohawk. They could go either way. Both of them ran as outsiders, so they could – endorse Harrell for his quote unquote outsider status, even though he was a member of city council and city council president up until about 2018. Or they could follow the issues and they could really look closely at who has a plan to actually address homelessness in Echohawk's case, or a plan to address gun violence and transportation in Farrell's case. Those are their kind of key issues. And, of course, that person is Lorena Gonzalez, because Bruce Harrell has been very careful not to articulate much in the way of plans, except for a plan to help businesses recover from COVID-19. So we'll see which way they go in terms of endorsing anyone, or if they just kind of step back and don't say anything at all, that would be interesting as well.
I was really surprised at how few people ended up voting for Andrew Grant Houston. I expected a much stronger turnout for him.
Yeah, I did too. But, you know, in a race where there's so many candidates, I just kind of wonder how many people were actually paying attention and attending or watching any of the candidate forums, and how many just said, oh, well, I'm happy with Bruce Harrell, or no, I'm happy with Lorena Gonzalez, or yeah, I know Colleen Echo-Hawk, I'll vote for her. Sometimes that's what people do if they recognize a person in a race and they're okay with that person. They don't go any further to kind of look into the issues and look at the candidates more closely. So while you and I may have been watching some of the candidate forums and were favorably impressed with Andrew Grant Houston and saw that he raised a lot of money and did a lot of campaigning, I don't think he actually did nearly as much campaigning as some of the other candidates, and he doesn't have the name recognition. Name recognition goes a long way in a field full of a lot of candidates like this.
Yeah. I also think that, you know, gaming, trying to game as an individual voter, trying to game the system factors into people's decisions. So
yeah, and I have to admit, I hate that. I am not a strategic voter. I've never been a strategic voter. I have always been a person who, if I like a candidate and I think they're going to do a good job, I will vote for them. I don't care how it affects, you know, who gets through to the primary, et cetera, because I really feel like, particularly in a big field of 15 candidates, you don't have a good sense of, you don't have perfect knowledge of what other voters are going to do. And the only time it makes sense to actually game or try to game the system is if you have close to perfect knowledge about what other voters are going to do. You know, so if, say, you vote for someone because you want them to get through the primary, even though maybe they're not your favored candidate and you think your favored candidate has enough votes to get through the primary and you want to shut out a far right candidate or something. Let's say you vote for somebody who isn't your favored candidate. You're operating in an environment where you don't have perfect knowledge, and assuming that your favored candidate is going to get through isn't, you know, isn't safe, you know. Mm-hmm. So I kind of feel like you pick your candidate and vote for them. Don't try to be playing the system, you know.
Yeah, it feels like you're just basically, you know, bringing the lottery tactics to
Lottery tactics are risky and can backfire, and I don't like to do that. I really think that the system works fine if you're honest, if voters are honest and vote for the candidate they support. So I, you know, Jav doesn't agree with me on that. He likes to be a strategic voter, and I just don't agree with that. So,
And there's some feedback about that coming up on the next race that I think we're going to talk about, the city attorney race.
Yeah, but before we move on, I want to say, too, it can be hard to tell in a race with so many, you know, I just made this point, in a race with so many candidates, what voters were thinking when they marked their ballots. And you can argue that a lot of voters in the mayor's race voted for candidates other than Gonzalez because they really wanted a change in city politics. If that's really the case, then Gonzalez could be in trouble in November. If the folks who supported Colleen Echo-Hawk, Justin Farrell, and Andrew Grant Houston were really hoping for an outsider and a fresh voice to come in versus voting for candidates on the issues. But if folks were really voting on the issues and align with the candidates who reflect those issues, then the folks who voted for Echo-Hawk, who voted for Farrell, who voted for Andrew Grant Houston, and some of the other outsider candidates would probably side more with Gonzalez, I think, than Harrell. There will be more of them siding with Gonzalez than Harrell. So I think Gonzalez is pretty well positioned to run a strong race in November. But, of course, a lot can happen in 3 months. So Jav and I will be looking at these races, looking at who spends how much money, what the campaigns are doing, and where things are going for the mayor's race. And hopefully there'll be more polls released too that will give us a better idea.
Yeah, since those are one of the big factors.
Yeah, and this time around there was only one or two polls released, and it was hard to tell, you know, because there were so many people who were undecided right up until the end.
Right. So it's going to be interesting regardless. But
yeah, so it's going to be interesting. Now, the Seattle City Attorney race. In this race, longtime incumbent Pete Holmes sent out an email just yesterday conceding the race to his two challengers, Nicole Thomas Kennedy, who's running on a platform of abolishing the city attorney's role in prosecuting criminal misdemeanor cases in Seattle Municipal Court, and conservative Ann Davison, who's running on a tough-on-crime platform that has exposed her unfamiliarity with the type of cases that are heard in Seattle Municipal Court. Thomas Kennedy took over 35%, Davison took 33% of the vote, and Holmes just 31% as of last night's returns. But he doesn't, there's a big enough gap between him and Ann Davison that he conceded yesterday. Mm-hmm. Thomas Kennedy, who has worked as a public defender, does know the ins and outs of the city's courts and wants to reform them, along with speeding up reforms at the Seattle Police Department. And that is the one area where Pete Holmes was really vulnerable, because even though he's been working along with the mayor and the city council and city government to try to put through reforms with the Seattle Police Department, it's been slow going. And he's been part of that process, and I think people have been really frustrated with how long the reform process has taken with the Seattle Police Department. Began back in 2012, and it, you know, we're coming up on a decade under the consent decree without a whole lot of progress. You know, I think there has been some progress, but you know, it's still looking like it could drag on for years. So we'll see how that goes. We'll see if Thomas Kennedy can affect faster change. I think whoever is elected as mayor in November is going to make a big difference in terms of how quickly that change is going to happen too.
Okay.
Now, given that a number of Holmes's supporters are going to be likely to vote for Thomas Kennedy, it looks like the city is going to stay on track for progressive reforms, but that may not be the case. I mean, Pete Holmes was the sort of in between Thomas Kennedy and Ann Davison. So we'll see how many of the folks who voted for him will go further to the left and vote for Nicole Thomas Kennedy, and how many are going to swing right and fall for Ann Davison's tough on crime platform and vote for her instead. So this race could be very close come November.
Oh yeah.
So we'll see. Now I'm assuming that that Seattle swings is currently leading more progressive, and I think a lot of the races in the city this year kind of show Seattle continuing to move in a progressive direction, but this race could surprise us in November.
Well, definitely with two relative unknowns leading that race.
I have to say, I think Nicole Thomas Kennedy ran a brilliant campaign. She didn't spend a whole lot of money, but she was very articulate about what she wanted to do, and she got her message out to all of the right outlets and all of the right people to really run on an issue that I think is an extremely important one, and that I think a lot of folks, particularly the more progressive folks in Seattle, agree with her on.
Mm-hmm.
So. But on the other hand, Ann Davison, without knowing, really even knowing what the Seattle Municipal Court does, you know, it took a surprising amount of the vote. The fact that she led the field in this race was kind of a shocker to me, you know. So I think, again, it kind of points up in the primary how many people, if they recognize, if they recognize someone, they will vote for them, or if they may respond kind of almost viscerally to certain messages that candidates project without digging deeper into the issues.
Well, and again, there's also the phenomena of people just voting against someone. So,
yeah, that's true.
They just don't like Pete Holmes. You know, I'm sick and tired of it, and I'm going to vote for this person. Yeah.
Yeah. They think, oh, no, you know, the homelessness and graffiti and closed businesses should all be laid at the feet of the city attorney. So let's vote him out of office.
Sure. Or the current incumbent.
Yeah. And I don't like that woman who's talking about abolishing. Now that sounds wrong. Let's vote for whoever's left. Right.
Right. So
there is that phenomenon too. So.
All right. Well, that's going to be a fascinating one to watch as
well. That'll be an interesting race to watch. But, you know, with Pete Holmes retiring, it seems to me like the end of an era in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, we're looking at the end of a lot of eras.
We are.
In the next couple years.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, embrace change. That's always kind of been my motto. As long as it's good change, embrace change. You know, so we will be moving forward. Come November, hopefully. Now, in the Seattle City Council positions, position 8, incumbent Teresa Mosqueda took a very comfortable 59% of the vote in a field with 11 candidates total. Happily, the political gadfly Kate Martin will not be making it through to November. Instead, small business owner Kenneth Wilson, who ran on a platform of reopening the West Seattle Bridge as soon as possible and standing in complete solidarity with the Seattle Police Department and not reforming the Seattle Police Department, will advance with only 17% of the vote. So I thought that was quite funny and shows you how many people agree with that position.
Mm-hmm.
And that Teresa Mosqueda looks like she is very, very well positioned to win in November, which is not a surprise. In the other race, Seattle City Council position 9, the race left open by Lorena Gonzalez's run for mayor, the two candidates who will advance to the general election are Sarah Nelson and Nikita Oliver, with less than 2,000 votes separating them. And Sarah Nelson was the leader in this race, which was a bit of a surprise to me as well, because Nikita Oliver outraised Sarah Nelson in terms of fundraising and has the credentials to go out and really campaign hard and run a grassroots campaign. Now, the third major candidate in this race, Brianna Thomas, no surprise, took just under 14% of the vote. She did not raise as much money and struggled to campaign well, particularly during candidate forums. She appeared very, very wonky in the forum that I watched, and I thought showed that she had a lot of experience on city council, but wasn't always able to explain her positions really well without going into details that could make your eyes cross. So she kind of struggled to condense and get her messages out. Now, Brianna Thomas took enough of the vote that if Nikita Oliver can win over the majority of those voters, they could beat Sarah Nelson in November. But this race will be close because Nelson could easily pick up a number of the folks who voted for Thomas because of her experience as Lorena Gonzalez's chief of staff. Nelson was an aide to former city council member Richard Conlon, and she's been playing that up quite a bit in her campaigning. This race is really going to be a test of whether Nikita Oliver can campaign citywide and beat a candidate who reflects the pro-business, go-slow direction of the mainstream Democratic Party here. Again, these races are nonpartisan, but Sarah Nelson is coming directly from that sort of mainstream Democratic Party platform of let's go back to the good old days in Seattle when, you know, mainstream Democrats were all pro-business and we all supported the Downtown Business Association and didn't question the police and continued to vote in big budget increases for the Seattle Police Department. This is going to be one of those races, I think, that we're going to have to watch very, very closely in November.
It's also going to be one of the races that we can expect significant PAC donations.
Yes, we'll see.
Very soon, or at least flyers coming to your mailbox from those entities.
Yes, we will. Let's talk a little bit about the Seattle School Board.
Okay.
Districts, two districts in Seattle that were up for election. District 4 is Queen Anne, Magnolia, and Ballard. That's Eden Mack's former district. Eden Mack had retired from her seat, saying that she just couldn't keep it up, and she criticized the extreme difficulty of doing a job that is primarily volunteer, pays almost nothing, and is not the part-time job that it's advertised to be, but is more of a full-time plus job. And of course, she had a point about that. Erin Durie was appointed to replace Eden Mack when she resigned, but Durie didn't make it through the primary. Instead, Vivian Song Merritts took a fantastic 59% of the vote, and so she's very strongly positioned to win in November. Her opponent will be Laura Marie Rivera, who took 22% of the vote. So that was good news. Vivian Song Merritts is a very strong candidate and I think would be a very good addition to the Seattle School Board. In District 5, which is downtown Capitol Hill in the Central District, happily Michelle Sarju took a whopping 85% of the vote, so she looks like she'll be a shoo-in in November. She will face Dan Harder, who is running on an anti-critical race theory platform, which he apparently doesn't understand. And he only took about 11% of the vote. So that's very good news in District 5. So okay. Vivian Song Merritts and Michelle Sarju look like they're going to be the winners in November. And they're moving on with very light challengers.
Okay.
So that's the wrap-up of the election. Of course, we're going to be keeping an eye on who spends what, who campaigns on what issues, the quality of their campaign ads, and who endorses who in the coming 3 months. So in some races, that's going to be quite interesting to watch, especially in the mayor's race.
Yeah. Looks like it's going to be a wild ride.
Yeah. Yeah. And, of course, in Council District 9, I want to see if Brianna Thomas endorses Nikita Oliver. Or if she endorses Sarah Nelson, or if she just kind of steps back and says, I don't endorse anybody. I want to see what happens there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, like I say, it's going to give us plenty to talk about over the next few months.
Well.
Inevitably, depending on who wins, inevitably after that as well.
Yeah. No.
All right. So, moving on. Interim Chief Diaz. Made an announcement this week.
Yes, this week, Interim Police Chief Adrian Diaz fired two of the officers who were at the Capitol Building riot in Washington, D.C. on January 6th, officers Alexander Everett and Caitlin Rochelle. These are the two officers who admitted to the OPA that they were in Washington, D.C. at the Capitol riot. Neither officer went inside the building, but they were caught on video standing at the foot of the Capitol steps while right-wing militants openly battled with Capitol Police around them to get entrance to the building. Four other SPD officers attended the Stop the Steal rally, but the OPA and the FBI have not found any video evidence that places them at the Capitol building that day when the violence began. Notably, the OPA and Interim Chief Diaz have chosen not to discipline those other four officers, even though I should point out that the purpose of the Stop the Steal rally was to stage a coup on Donald Trump's behalf by gathering his supporters in Washington, D.C., firing them up with lies and then sending them to march over to break into the Capitol building where the Congress was certifying the vote in favor of Joe Biden for president. And here in Seattle, the Community Police Commission has urged Interim Chief Diaz to fire all six of the officers. He has so far only fired two. Mm-hmm. Diaz also offered an apology this week to the Capitol Police, but he only apologized for the presence of the two officers at the Capitol building, not the presence of all six at the Stop the Steal rally. Now, these two officers can appeal their termination to the Public Safety Civil Service Commission, or they could request an arbitration hearing to overturn their termination. And my guess is they will probably do one of those two things, or probably the arbitration hearing, since that's the route through which most SPD officers have been able to overturn their firings in the past. And is currently the loophole in the Seattle Police Department contract that the court monitor and the judge overseeing the consent decree have both said is problematic and a violation of the police reform law that the city council passed to try to reform the Seattle Police Department. So we'll see. If these two officers go through arbitration, my guess is they probably will.
Yeah. All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Well, on to some of the few things Mayor Durkan is doing in the next few months.
Well, she did something this week that probably wasn't a surprise. She returned two bills to the city council instead of signing them or vetoing them. Her action or inaction means that these two bills will go into effect without her approval. And the reason she refused to sign the two bills is because they both put some limits on the mayor's office. The first bill creates a fund for the Jumpstart payroll tax revenue to be deposited into, which is separate from the city's general fund, and it specifies what the money can be spent on, initially on COVID-19 relief, then on things like affordable housing, homelessness services, equitable development, small business support, and Green New Deal initiatives. This, of course, limits what the mayor can do when writing her proposed budget. She can't just take revenue from the new Jumpstart payroll tax and use it to plug holes wherever she wants, or uses to spend it on programs that she thinks are great equitable development programs versus what the city council would support. Now, and Mayor Durkan, of course, complained about that in her letter to the council when she returned that bill to them. And in that letter, she says that she wanted to veto the bill, but knows that the council would have the votes to overturn her veto, so she's just gonna complain to them, here's your bill back, this is why I don't like it. So the second bill that she returned will set up a new Office of Economic and Revenue Forecasts, which will be overseen jointly by the mayor's office and the city council. Mayor Durkan sent it back with a letter attached to it, of course, arguing that it would require an amendment, or that it should require an amendment to the city charter to create a new city department that's not directly overseen solely by the mayor. However, the city council in the past has done this before. They created the Seattle Ethics and Election Commission through a city council ordinance, and the members of that body are appointed by both the mayor and the city council, and it's overseen by both. So Durkan said that she didn't veto the bill for that reason, because if she had vetoed this bill setting up the Office of Economic and Revenue Forecasts, it would jeopardize the Seattle Ethics and Election Commission, which was set up in the same way. So in a way, she's kind of acknowledging that, yeah, the city council has done it before. So, you know, my earlier argument isn't really kosher, but I'm going to state that argument anyway. You know, they did it once, but they should never do it again, I guess. But I think clearly the mayor is just not happy that the council wants an independent body to prepare estimates of the city's tax and fee revenues that the council can then use to compare with what the mayor's office puts together as part of the budget, mayor's budget proposal. As far as I'm concerned, the more information, the better, right? And given that the city council staff had to do a ton of work this past year to decode the mayor's budget proposals last year, this could provide the city council with a little more time and information that they can use to review and make changes to the mayor's proposed budget. Of course, it's not going to help them this year, but it will help next year.
It seems like Mayor Durkin has returned quite a number of bills unsigned during her tenure. It just seems like I'm hearing it more with her reign than with previous mayors, but I might not have been awake when this was mentioned during previous mayors.
Yeah, or it could just be there's more coverage of this because it's become apparent that there's a very prickly relationship between Mayor Durkin and the city council. It could just be sexism on the part of local media because women are viewed more critically and Mayor Durkin is a woman. It does appear that she does return a number of bills unsigned. I don't know that the number is higher for her than it was for, say, Greg Nichols or for Mike McGinn. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the media did cover his tenure as mayor in the same way, you know, would point up friction between him and the city council. And, you know, Seattle has, I think, a unique history, modern history, with electing a new mayor almost every 4 years.
Yeah.
So we have not had a long-term mayor in that seat for a very long time. I think the last one, you would have to go back to the 90s, really. Mm-hmm. And this issue of electing a new mayor every 4 years, I think just makes it really, really hard for a mayor to establish a relationship with a city council and to get their, if they have a platform when they're elected to office, it makes it more difficult for them to fully realize and push for and see real changes and to institute the changes in their platform if they're only in office for 4 years. So that's kind of been a feature of modern Seattle politics, is that every 4 years we say, you know, kick out the old person and put in a new one. And we'll see if that changes with the new mayor or not.
We shall.
Yeah. So speaking a little bit, too, to the budget, mm-hmm. I was sort of hoping there'd be a less contentious budget process this year, since it's going to be the last year for Mayor Durkin to send a budget proposal to the city council. But I have to say that Durkin's refusal to sign these two bills isn't a good sign for that. Of course, the council is going to be working with the possibility this year that the current council president, Lorena Gonzalez, could be the next mayor in 2022. So we'll see how that all impacts the changes that they propose to this year's budget. Mayor Durkin is expected to release her budget proposal by the end of this month. Then the city council will go into budget-only mode when all their other committees and legislation are put on hold for the following 3 months while they discuss and hammer out changes to the mayor's budget. They typically have a final budget completed by Thanksgiving week. And like last year, the city council's budget meetings will be held virtually, so you'll be able to watch them while they happen and after they happen. But you'll also be able to, if you watch them live, contribute to the comments at the beginning of each meeting, which was new last year. And I think Teresa Mosqueda did a really good job at moderating those and allowing those at each budget meeting. And it'll be interesting to watch them again this year. Now, last year, the emphasis was on defunding the Seattle Police Department and reallocating funds for community public safety, funding for racial equity and housing and homelessness. And of course, COVID-19 relief. This year, the city council will be looking at the jumpstart payroll tax revenue and what to spend it on, discussing further reforms to the city's public safety budget, and, you know, maybe going beyond that 6% cut to the Seattle Police Department that they did last year, and reckoning with programs that Mayor Durkin has refused to fund or slow walked the funding for, including tiny home villages, which a number of them were funded with last year's budget, and none have new ones have opened this year, and funding for enhanced hotel-based shelters. Again, the city has slow-walked those, and diversion programs. So that's what we can expect to see the city council discussing in the coming months.
All right. Also this week, some relief funding coming Seattle to me.
Yeah, the second package of COVID-19 relief funds were announced this week. Mayor Durkin, Council President Lorena Gonzalez, and City Council Budget Chair Teresa Mosqueda released the plan for spending $52.2 million in a second wave of COVID-19 relief funds. It includes money for $28.7 million in rental assistance, which will be needed at the end of September when the city's eviction moratorium expires. $10.9 million in federal grant money for the Madison Street Bus Rapid Transit Line G, which will run from the waterfront via Madison Street through First Hill to Madison Valley. $7.4 million in assistance for seniors and the elderly. $2.5 million in assistance for the monorail and the streetcar system. The monorail will get $1.5 million, and the streetcar system will get $700,000 to shore them up because of the loss of ridership fares. And $2.2 million will go to McCaw Hall at the Seattle Center, and that hall is where the Seattle Opera performs. It has been sitting pretty much vacant, and the city has not had had revenue. But, of course, those big buildings require constant maintenance and upgrades. So that is also in the budget.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Okay.
That wraps up local news.
Jump over to national and this week's pandemic-related news.
COVID-19 news. Yeah, we are in the midst of a steep surge in COVID-19 cases nationally. With over 100,000 new cases per day in the United States, the surge has not been a slow one. It is a steep one. Fortunately, the vaccines are protecting a lot of people because deaths are not skyrocketing along with the new cases. Last week, we saw an average of 489 deaths per day. That's still more than double the number of deaths a month ago, but not even close to the over 3,000 deaths per day we saw during the winter months. Now, while new cases of COVID-19 have increased almost tenfold, deaths have only doubled, not increased tenfold. So that is good, grim news, but good news. But still, too many people are dying from the Delta variant. And I should point out that, yes, some of those folks are vaccinated. If you have comorbidities like diabetes, heart disease, asthma, obesity, or an autoimmune disorder like MS, lupus, or rheumatoid arthritis, you still need to protect yourself because you can still get deathly ill even if you've been vaccinated. That is a very important message that I think is missing from the messaging that's coming out of the CDC. If you have a comorbidity, as nearly half of all Americans over the age of 40 have, you need to still be protecting yourself when you're in public. Wear a mask and be careful to not go places where there are large crowds of people, particularly young people who make up the majority of folks who are not vaccinated. There's a new COVID-19 variant, the Delta Plus variant, it has a new mutation of the spike protein, which makes it even more contagious than the Delta variant, which is at least twice as contagious as the original form of the COVID-19 virus. However, you know, that means the Delta variant is still plenty contagious, and there's no evidence yet of the Delta plus variant overtaking it as the dominant form of the virus, not in this country and not in any other country, even though it has arisen in at least 11 different nations around the world. The Delta plus variant, however, is concerning still because it seems to bind more easily to lung cells, which would make it more dangerous than other variants and more deadly. It may also be more resistant to treatments. So bottom line there is that you could get more sick from the Delta plus variant and doctors wouldn't have a lot of tools to treat you. So that's very concerning. Of course, it's more proof that we need to get more people vaccinated so that they're both protected from these more lethal forms of the virus and so that they don't get sick and create yet another new, more lethal variant of the virus, because that's how the virus mutates. The more people who get sick from it, the more likely new mutations will arise. Now, for people who are waiting to get vaccinated because they're concerned about the vaccine making them sick, they need to know that their priorities are backwards. Okay, your priorities are backwards. Without the vaccine, they stand to get extremely ill from the new forms of the virus, which can now more easily kill them than the original form of COVID-19. The only protection they have is vaccination, because there is no such thing as herd immunity when you only have around 70%, or in some states, far less than 50% of the population vaccinated. And of course, that's especially true now that U.S. politicians and the CDC have largely caved into pressure from the business community to reopen the economy, regardless of the public health impact. That's the reality, and we have to recognize it. The CDC and politicians are not going to roll back the reopening. They're just going to sort of throw caution to the wind and not care about the public health impact, because, you know, They have to deal with donations from their major supporters, right?
Sure.
And that's rich people and businesses, and they want the economy open. So that's what's happening. Hell or high water. Mm. Okay. Meanwhile, employers really need to mandate vaccination before they let employees come back to work. I firmly believe that. And I don't see a reason for employers to not mandate vaccinations. This week, CNN fired 3 employees who returned to their office building without being vaccinated. Good for them. After CNN management had required all staff to be vaccinated in order to enter the building. In late July, New Jersey's largest healthcare provider, RWJ Barnabas Health, fired 6 senior healthcare workers who refused to take the vaccine and did not have either a medical or religious exemption. Good for them. In June, Houston Methodist, one of the first healthcare employers to require vaccinations in the nation, fired or accepted resignations from 153 staff who refused to get vaccinated. Several of those employees sued, saying that they wouldn't be, quote unquote, guinea pigs for vaccines that hadn't received FDA approval. But a federal district court judge dismissed that case in July. Good for him, her, and good for Houston Methodist. Now, in fact, I want to point out the FDA has authorized all 3 vaccines. Okay, the FDA has authorized all 3 vaccines for emergency use. That's not a nothing process, okay? That's a something process, right? That process involved clinical trials of tens of thousands of people. The FDA announced this week that it plans to give full approval to the Pfizer vaccine within the next month. The Moderna vaccine, Moderna is actually still submitting data to the FDA, so there isn't a timeline yet for its full approval, but it is in the middle of that process, right? Johnson & Johnson has not yet submitted the application for full approval, but has plans to complete that by the end of the year. But all 3 vaccines have been approved by the FDA for emergency use. Okay. And that process was not just we're signing a document and it's done. It involved clinical trials. It involved tens of thousands of people. And so far, 194 million Americans have received at least one vaccination shot. That's over 70% of the nation's adult population and 58% of the total population. 50% of the population is fully vaccinated and has had two shots of the two shot regimens, and no major illnesses have arisen from the vaccines. That is the largest clinical trial in history. Okay. And it's leading to the approval to the Pfizer vaccine. It is time for holdouts to get vaccinated. Now, some of the employers who are requiring all employers to be vaccinated include the City of San Francisco, the Commonwealth of Virginia, the Department of Veteran Affairs, the Mayo Clinic, and many large private employers, including Microsoft, Facebook, Ford, Google, Lyft, Netflix, Morgan Stanley, Delta Airlines, Twitter, Goldman Sachs, Uber, DoorDash, Walgreens, United Airlines, Walmart, Tyson Foods, and Disney. And that's just to name a few. And here in Seattle, the Swedish hospital chain, Virginia Mason and Franciscan Health just announced this week that they are requiring all employees to be vaccinated. Now, some employers have encouraged vaccinations, saying something along the lines of, we want you to get vaccinated or else take a daily coronavirus test to prove that you're not sick and wear a mask at work. Now, this includes the states of New York and California and the federal government. But I should point out that those quick COVID-19 tests are not reliable. Mm-hmm. So a mandate is really necessary now, and employers need to issue mandates. And I'm going to call out the states who are lagging behind in vaccinations. And this is my roll call of shame. For those states that have a population that are under 50% fully vaccinated, I'll try to do this really quickly. Alabama, Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Illinois, Indiana, Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, come on, Montana, Nevada, North Carolina, North Dakota, Ohio? Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, West Virginia, and Wyoming. That is 28 states, well over half the states in the U.S. And they're not all Republican governors and Republican legislatures, and they need to step up, okay? Now, you'll notice that South Dakota is on that list. This weekend is the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally, which draws hundreds of thousands of people to the Black Hills in South Dakota. Last year, it helped to spread COVID-19 throughout the United States, particularly the Midwest states. This year, attendance is expected to top 700,000 people. And with the Delta variant, it's expected to be an even bigger super spreader event this year than it was last year, especially since Meade County, South Dakota, has been designated by the CDC as an area of, quote, high community transmission, end quote, of the COVID-19 virus. Only 37% of Meade County residents are fully vaccinated, and the percentage among participants in the rally is probably about the same, I would guess. Other recent super spreader events include the Lollapalooza Music Festival just about a week ago, where 385,000 unmasked people spent a weekend partying in Chicago. Another super spreader event was the celebration of the Milwaukee Bucks winning their first NBA championship, where about 500 people so far have contracted COVID-19. And the Rolling Loud Hip Hop Music Festival in Florida was another super spreader event. And the Verknipt Outdoor Music Festival in Netherlands just a couple weeks ago, where over 1,000 people contracted the Delta variant of COVID-19. And that has led the Illinois Department of Health to ask people who attended Lollapalooza last weekend to get tested for COVID-19 as soon as possible, to help them stop the spread of the infection. And there's been a lot of debate about resuming outdoor music festivals and gatherings where people are packed together and no one is wearing a mask. And you can see that in the photos and videos that people have taken of these large outdoor events like Lollapalooza, people packed together and not a single person wearing a mask.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we will pick up.
We'll be back next week.
Where we left off, same time next week.
Yes, and hopefully Jav will be back with us.
Fingers crossed, yeah.